Hi, I'm Lauren Gilger, co-host of the show, an original production from KJZZ. Every weekday, we bring you the latest news and culture from across the state. You can find much more at theshow.kjzz.org. Here's today's episode. Good morning and welcome to the show here on KJZZ 91.5 in Phoenix. I'm Lauren Gilger. Coming up, a preview of what could be a tough wildfire season in Arizona and a plea to fund more firefighters. And we will bring you a tiny desert concert where you'll meet a young band that relishes an awkward show. But first, two of the top Democrats in the state are at odds with the Republican Senate president after he turned over a trove of records to the FBI related to Arizona's 2020 election. And now there are questions about the state's top DOJ attorney and his involvement. Last month, State Senator Warren Peterson gave federal officials electronic records from the controversial Cyber Ninjas audit of Arizona's 2020 election as part of their ongoing investigation into that election, which President Trump lost to Joe Biden. Since, there has been a dizzying back and forth between Arizona Attorney General Chris Mays and Secretary of State Adrian Fontes and Peterson as they voice concerns about voter information, and Peterson pushes back. Wayne Shetsky with KJZZ's politics desk has been covering it all, and he joins me now to walk us through this fight. Good morning, Wayne.
Good morning.
Okay, so what is the federal government up to here? Like, why are they investigating the 2020 election?
In a nutshell, they are essentially rehashing President Trump's grievances about the 2020 election, which obviously he lost, and lost in Arizona to Democrat Joe Biden. So he's long claimed without evidence that widespread fraud led to that loss. And it just looks like now that he's back in power, he's using the levers of government to go back and dig back into some of those conspiracies.
Okay, so what records did Peterson turn over to the FBI? This wasn't quite the same as all those headlines we saw about Fulton County, Georgia, right, where the FBI raided election offices. This was the records from this so-called audit that has been, as I think you put it in your story, much maligned.
Yeah. No raid necessary. They presented President Peterson with a subpoena, and we don't know exactly all of the records specifically, but he turned over terabytes and terabytes, which is just a huge amount of data from that audit, which was where they, you know, had the little spinning lazy Susans and all sorts of stuff, and were looking at counting Maricopa County's ballots to try and verify the election. Mm-hmm. Obviously, a lot of election experts said that situation was really not professional, not done the right way, and you can't really trust the results, though they did show that Joe Biden won. However, all the documents they got, you know, all sorts of election-related documents from Maricopa County, that's kind of the concern. So that was likely mm-hmm. included in the tranche of data that he turned over.
I remember the scenes at the state fairgrounds, right?
Yep.
Okay, so what are Fontes and Mays concerned about here?
So they think this is happening parallel to the DOJ's effort to get access to completely unredacted voter rolls in Arizona and other states, which Mays and Fontes are fighting in court. And
yes.
So they basically sent a letter out to all the county recorders across the state and said, hey, if the DOJ comes with you with similar subpoenas like they did with the Senate president for your voter records, do not comply, whether or not they have a grand jury subpoena or not, because mm-hmm. We think that would violate federal state privacy laws because of all the personal information and private voter information included in there. So they're saying, don't do it, subpoena or not.
Okay. So they sent this letter and Peterson shot back, referred them for obstruction of justice.
Yeah, he basically wrote to U.S. Attorney Kershane and said, hey, I believe that this is obstruction of justice, witness tampering. Like, can you please look into this, basically?
Okay. And now you've got a response from the U.S. Attorney for Arizona, and he was pretty forthcoming.
Yeah. He said he's taking a look at these allegations, but also seemed very sympathetic to Peterson's allegations in there, you know, saying that I think astonishing was the word he would use, that these officials would try to interfere with the grand jury's duty.
Hmm. Tell us what we know about this U.S. Attorney, Kershane.
So he's not like some of these more controversial figures we've seen, especially in a lot of East Coast states that Trump appointees, you know, personal Trump attorneys, folks that have no DOJ experience, just being thrust into these roles for which they have very little experience. He's a former assistant U.S. attorney. He clerked for Arizona Supreme Court Justice Bill Montgomery. He's got a background in this. Like he made sense as an appointee. He was actually reappointed by the district court because he hasn't been Senate confirmed. So that's a process that's required. So mm-hmm. We've seen other Trump appointees, some of these more political figures, not receive that reappointment. So, I mean, on the surface, he seems like a pretty typical DOJ appointee for a Republican president.
Okay. Is this out of the ordinary, though, Wayne, that the U.S. attorney here sort of, you know, saying what he thinks very clearly in this?
I mean, less and less so in this era of politics we are in. But typically when, like, for instance, if I reach out and ask about an investigation, the response is very short and curt. And, you know, we don't comment on pending investigations, or this has been referred to an investigative agency like the FBI. That's a response I've gotten. Last time President Peterson did this with Senator Annalise Ortiz when she was notifying folks about ICE in their communities, he sent a letter to the DOJ basically asking the same thing. Can you look into this? Did it break the law? And the DOJ's response to me at that time was essentially, we're not an investigative agency.
Right.
But we're looking and sending this maybe to the FBI or whoever. So very different than that past situation.
Yeah, very different response. What did Mays and Fontes have to say about that?
They basically said it's ridiculous and that it's political posturing and that, you know, they're doing what they believe their duty is, complying with the law. And they think this is just a political effort both by Senate President Peterson, who happens to be running against Attorney General Mays potentially to be the next AG, and U.S. Attorney Kirshane to just appease Trump, basically.
So, Wayne, what does all of this mean for the upcoming midterms elections? Like, we've seen a lot of reporting, a lot of folks concerned about potential efforts by the Trump administration to change election norms, to, you know, maybe claim election interference. There are concerns about what could happen coming up here. How does this all play into that larger narrative?
Yeah, we've seen the Trump administration, you know, President Trump himself trying to use executive orders to give the federal government more power over elections. And we're still trying to see how that plays out. So, you know, especially Democrats believe this is part of that effort to either give an excuse to kind of take over control of those elections or to just sow doubt. And so if, you know, as is expected right now, Democrats do relatively well in the midterms, that then they can use these type of situations to sow doubt and claim that, you know, there was some sort of funny business going on versus just the electorate, you know, doing what it usually does, which is sending the midterms to the opposite party.
Right. And one more question there on what you just alluded to, which is that the midterms are coming up and we do expect, it sounds like based on polling, that Democrats could do pretty well. This could shape things.
Yeah. I mean, that's again. Yeah. And that's not abnormal, you know, especially right now. President Trump, it's proven a lot of the stuff he's doing right now, the Iran war, things like that are very unpopular with voters. And so assuming that kind of stays the course, that is going to give momentum to Democrats. Plus, you know, the minority party typically does well, the party not in the White House in midterms almost every cycle like this. So yeah, the Democrats have a lot of headwinds, and this could be a Republican attempt, they think, to just trying to tamp down on those.
Okay, we'll see what happens. KJZZ's Wayne Shetsky with our politics desk. Wayne, thanks as always.
Yeah, thank you.
It has been one of the hottest winters and now springs on record in Arizona this year. There has never been a hotter March recorded in Phoenix than last month. The valley's temperatures were an astonishing 12 degrees above normal. And on top of that, it's been incredibly dry across the state, too. This was the 13th driest March on record across Arizona. And in Flagstaff, where we expect to see snow every winter, March left them 58 inches behind normal this year. And all of that means we could be looking at a tough wildfire season coming up. John Truitt is state fire manager and officer for the Arizona Department of Forestry and Fire Management. He's on the line now to tell me more about what we might expect this upcoming wildfire season. Good morning, John.
Good morning.
All right. So this year we saw, as I outlined there, like an incredibly warm winter, a spring heat wave that didn't really let up. And, you know, any snow that had fallen in the North Country has pretty much melted. What does all of this mean for wildfire season?
Well, what it means is it's going to cure out our fuels faster than normal, and there's no real moisture in the soil right now, so we're not going to get a very long green up, if at all. So right now we're on that downward trend of our green up and getting into a cured state in our fuels out there across the state.
So when you say a green up, like every year in the spring, you expect rain and then the green to come, right? The grass to grow, the trees to bloom, and then it dries out in the summer. But this is coming early.
Yeah, that's just the cycle of our vegetation out there. Every spring we get a green up no matter what kind of rain we get. But it's a short duration this time. And, you know, we're already 4 to 6 weeks ahead of time on our curing out of our vegetation.
Okay, so does that mean a wildfire season could start earlier than normal this year?
The potential is there, as you've seen a couple in the last week or so, a little bit of cooler weather in and out. But yeah, it's going to be definitely an early start. We're having fire starts now. They're not getting outside of a single day burning period yet, but that is very close at hand.
Okay. I remember after some wet winters in the state saying, you know, all of that water means there's more grass, there's more greenery, and that bodes badly for wildfire season when all that dries out. Is there some kind of silver lining here in the fact that we just haven't had much rain, so there won't be quite as much green to begin with?
In a normal cycle, yes. But if you remember, recall last fall, we had an abundance of rain, which created an above normal grass crop. So, yeah, the cycles are a little bit off, but in a normal year, we get less rain, we'll get less growth, and a little bit less what we call fuel loading out there of our vegetation.
Okay. All right. Your department and Governor Katie Hobbs announced recently this new AZ Fire Cam system. It's 360-degree view cameras that are kind of placed around the state that I think the idea is you can detect smoke early. What might these do for catching those fires right away?
It's more of a detection tool for us. We've got them out in an area of what we call low frequency, but high value at risk. So our response times are really going to be based on our staffing, and our staffing is, you know, it's low at best. So these will give us at least the intel that we have a fire start. And when we look at that image of that smoke, we can tell how hot it's burning and if it's going to be a priority. You know, right off the bat, we can launch more resources to it that if we have them available.
Right. So let me ask you about resources. We've reported in the past on this kind of ongoing major shortage of firefighters, particularly, I think, wildland firefighters around the country and here as well. How do you try to get folks on board? What's the department doing to try to make a dent there?
Well, for us, it's on our recruiting side. You know, unfortunately, we're just limited on how many firefighters we can hire, and we're at maximum as we speak now. So really, we needed to add more positions to the statewide Arizona state firefighting workforce. When it comes to our local government, our fire departments, our fire districts, they're having shortages as well, just kind of based on their budgets and their availability to hire out there just because of the shortage of any type of funding that those individual departments have.
Oh, so that's interesting. So it's not a matter of getting people into the field. It's a matter of having the budget to hire them?
Exactly. We're very short-staffed when it comes to a statewide fire department, per se. And, you know, we could use a few more folks and a few more permanent positions to provide that coverage and that public safety throughout the state.
I mean, that's got to be a concern, especially as we're looking at these kind of increasingly dangerous wildfire seasons across the state. And as you're saying, this one could start early. Why isn't the funding there? What's the conversation like with policy leaders?
It's all about what we call FTEs and, you know, full-time employees. And we're, you know, always, you know, talking with the legislators, talking with the folks downtown to, you know, just to make them aware of that we have an increasing fire danger out there. We have increasing urban sprawl beyond these fire district boundaries that become the responsibility of the state. And it's just needing to keep up with the growth of the state is what we're trying to advocate.
Mm. So I always wonder this because we've seen the temperatures, especially in the summer here, not just in the valley, but across the state go up, you know, so much in recent years. How much harder does the job get in fighting wildfires when we see these temperatures rise and you see, you know, 110, 115 sometimes when you're also out there fighting a fire?
Yeah, it's just, again, it's on how we manage our personnel out there. You know, obviously you can't go, you know, 10 hours straight when our fire environment is like that. So we make sure we give them breaks at the proper time, you know, and it's all about physical conditioning. And, you know, we really rely heavily on the physical science behind, you know, hydration and rest work and all that. So we pay a lot of attention to it, but we can only do so much on an extreme environment.
Yeah, absolutely. Let me ask you lastly, there are reports that Arizona should be expecting what's being called like a super El Nino this year, which could, you know, be good news. It could bring cooler temperatures, some much needed rain to the region, maybe a lot of rain, in fact. Are you looking at that? Could this mean a wetter monsoon season help things out when fire season gets underway?
Yeah, in our business, the fire service, we work real close with the National Weather Service, you know, because fire is a science behind it, and weather is one of the driving factors of it. And what we've been talking with the National Weather Service is that super El Nino coming in. It's all going to be about timing. It could be coming in, you know, as early as July, but as late as the fall. So it's really the timing of when all that comes and kind of add to our monsoon season. But it'll be late, and some of our opinions and some of the facts that we're getting from the National Weather Service, it may not come in until late July or August. So it'll help a little bit, but that may be a little bit too late.
Okay. All right. John Truitt, State Fire Manager and Officer for the Arizona Department of Forestry and Fire Management, here with a wildfire season preview. John, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Good morning. It is the show here on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger. Coming up, a local electro clash indie sleaze revival band gives an inside look at their self-produced live performances.
We slowly have been like putting in like synths and like samplers and like guitars and drums to like really make it like a live thing for us. Yeah. And I think we're just trying to have this blend that no one else has, where it's like, you know, a band that's also like doing a DJ set.
Yeah. Our Tiny Desert concert series continues with a duo called Belgium Tree. But first, the Center for Creative Photography at the University of Arizona says it's acquired the archives of 9 photographers. Among them is Mark Klett, who's been photographing the Sonoran Desert for decades. Even if you don't know his name, you've almost certainly seen Klett's photos. He's been shooting them since he came to Arizona in 1982. His images feature iconic desert scenes, often including saguaros. As part of our series on the Sonoran Desert called Saguaro Land a couple of years ago, my co-host Mark Brody met with Klett at his studio, which is just through the backyard of his Tempe home. The building, which he shares with his family, features several printers, computers, and boxes upon boxes of photos. That's not to mention the nearly floor-to-ceiling desert images on the wall and the large-scale portraits taken by his wife that hang at one end of the studio. Mark started the conversation by asking Klett how he looks at the desert differently now than he did when he started in the early 80s.
Oh, yeah. It's kind of hard for me to even remember what I thought when I first came here in the 1980s. But it was definitely not a place I was familiar with. I came from Idaho, and it was February. And the first thing I noticed was it was nice and warm. And I thought, what am I getting myself into down here? But I had a lot of time on the weekends, and I would travel around to just try to understand this place that I lived in. I wasn't familiar at all with the desert, with the plants, the cactus, the way that the landscape looked, the geography. And so my way of introducing myself to it was just to go out and have an experience.
What about it appeals to you as an artist, as a photographer?
Well, that's an interesting question. The thing I was kind of poised to understand about this place was that it has the appearance initially of being a place that's untouched, and that's not true. And you go out and you start looking around, soon realize that there's a history here. And one of the things that does happen in the desert, unlike other places in the country, is that history often remains visible over time. So if somebody drives across the desert, for example, that track could be visible for decades and decades after that. If someone built a dwelling, say a Native American site, that could still be visible hundreds of years later. So this record is, to me, really interesting, that You can see this history of the passage of people. And that's one of the things that really drew me to the place, was that I realized it wasn't just my experience. This was multiple experiences over time. So when I went out, I was looking for that. I was looking for the signs of that passage.
When you look at the desert and you're trying to find a spot, you know, a site to take your photos, what do you look for now? And I'm wondering if that's maybe different than what you would have looked for in the past.
Yeah, I think that when I first started, I was just photographing anything that seemed curious to me. You know, one of the ways that you work, or I work as an artist, is that it's intuitive. I don't really know what I'm trying to do when I start. I go out there, and the first thing you have to do is just do something. So I'm photographing something I'm curious about, or maybe I like the light, or I like the composition, I can work with it. But after a while, then I'm thinking, what am I looking at? What kinds of things am I looking at? Why does it look this way? What's the history of something I'm seeing? And so that involves research. Well, what's happened to me over time is that I've built up a lot of that. You know, I've gotten to know the place a lot more. I've read a lot of the history, you know. And so when I go out now, I'm quite aware of things that I wasn't aware of, you know, 40 years ago. So I do make different pictures.
Do you have an estimate as far as how many photos of saguaros you've taken over the years?
No, I'd hate to estimate that. Well, I mean, it wouldn't seem too outrageous even if I could remember it, because I was working in the old days. I worked with film and a 4x5-inch camera. It's a camera and a type of way working that you don't work super quickly. Now I work with a digital camera, but it requires the same kind of thing. You have to put it on a tripod and set it up. So it's a slower way of working, but it's a much more detailed way. So, I mean, somebody today with a DSLR or a digital camera can go out and shoot just thousands and thousands of pictures in a short period of time on a card, which we wouldn't do in the old days because it cost too much with film, even if you could try to do it. So I haven't done that many. I would put the number in, say, the thousands, but it wouldn't be like somebody could do today with a different kind of camera.
What do you think that you learn about the Sonoran Desert through photographing it?
Well, again, it's that research. So I've been interested in saguaros, as you mentioned, ever since I got here. And I didn't know much about them when I started. I was responding to their shape, to their to the way they were articulated, to the kind of gestures that they made, their kind of reference to the human form, that sort of thing. But then over time, you know, I research more about saguaros and read about them. So, you know, I think that the research on any subject that I run across, that impacts my vision. You know, when I get that information, the next time I go out, I see things a little bit differently. So photography can start off as being a simple response to something. But I think in the end, for it to become meaningful, it often has to evolve in the way that it works into more knowledge.
Do you consider it maybe part of your mission or part of your job to teach people a little bit about the Sonoran Desert? I mean, your photographs are not just seen here in the valley. They're seen all over the country, all over the world. Do you feel that you're trying to maybe teach people or maybe get people to appreciate or understand the desert a little more through your photographs?
Well, I hope maybe appreciate. I don't know if I'm the best person to teach them really substantial facts about the desert. But I think if it makes people realize that this place isn't just an iconic, you know, desert where people might think, if they're not from around here, for example, they might think, oh, the desert's this dry, dusty place full of sand, and it's all the cactus have two arms that look like somebody sticking their arms up in a hold up. And, you know, if it's just not this iconic, generic view of what a desert is, but instead it's this really diverse land with an incredible history to it, that's the history layered with different cultures. You know, if that can get people to think about the richness of this place, then I feel good about it.
It's interesting what you say about how the perception of the Sonoran Desert for a lot of people who are not from here is that it's dry and dusty and not a lot lives here and not a lot grows here. You've been taking photos of it, as you said, since the early 80s. Have you gotten bored with it ever? Like, do you still see things, different things, or maybe look at things differently or find new spots that you maybe, you know, didn't know about before that really keeps it interesting?
No, I don't get bored. In fact, I've thought, or, you know, my wife and I have thought sometimes, you know, do we want to live someplace else? And we both agree that we just couldn't part with the desert. I think that it's just too important to me now. The experience of the place never gets old for me. It's a place where danger and beauty and uncertainty all come together.
What you're saying is, like, when you're out in the desert, it's the real thing. It's not Disneyland. It's not a national park. Like, this is it. Almost anything can happen out there.
Yeah, and I don't mean to denigrate the national parks because they're still incredibly beautiful and gorgeous places, but I think it's not curated in a sense. There aren't any interpretive signs. There aren't any campgrounds where I go. There aren't any safety features, you know. And if you break down, you run out of water, or you run across a band of smugglers in the wrong place, nobody's going to help you out. You know, this is the place where, you know, you're taking charge of your own life at that point. And yet, it's also the place of incredible beauty.
Mark Klett, thanks a lot for having us here. I appreciate it.
Well, thanks for coming.
Good morning. It is the show on KJZZ 91.5. I am Lauren Gilger. The Valley has a well-earned reputation as a place that doesn't always honor its past. That's evident in the number of historic buildings we've lost over the years and continue to lose. But KJZZ contributor Robert Pala has a different story about one beloved spot.
Here's a bit of news. For once, Phoenix's long-suffering crew of historic preservationists has scored a victory. Mystery Castle, that oddball stone and scrap fortress perched atop South Mountain, has been spared from demolition. Mystery Castle was a tourist stop owned and operated by Mary Lou Gully, who lived there until her death in 2010. Her father had built the house for her in the 1930s using telephone poles, automobile parts, adobe, stone, and whatever else Boyce Luther Gully could get his hands on. After his death in the mid-1940s, Mary Lou and her mother began offering paid tours of the place. For decades, visitors wandered its rooms, heard its stories, and experienced it as a home shown by the woman for whom it had been built, rather than as a piece of Sonoran history. After years of neglect and vandalism, the owner of this weird local landmark, who had inherited it from Mary Lou, threw in the towel. She boarded the joint up in 2024, sold off its contents, and filed for a demolition permit. Local outcry from fans of the place led to a new owner, who recently stepped in with a pledge to preserve Mystery Castle. The Harrell family of companies, which has been involved in other local historical preservation projects, has promised to rehab the castle and once again welcome visitors to its long dilapidated walls. Cut to sighs of relief and nostalgic Facebook posts from locals who once toured Mystery Castle on a fourth grade field trip. The new owners have floated the idea of turning Mystery Castle into a destination event venue. Okay, but event venues are tidy. They're designed to be safe, rentable, and photogenic. Mystery Castle was none of those things. It was precarious and eccentric, a folk art fever dream made by a guy who wasn't a builder. How is the Harrell family going to turn that into an event venue? And if they do, will it still be Mystery Castle? I'm reminded of all the nice people in the world who buy old houses for their quaint charm and then rip out all the quaint charm and replace it with granite countertops and open floor plans and ceiling fans because, I don't know, why do people do this? Why not just buy a new house? Mystery Castle isn't a stately Frank Lloyd Wright masterpiece or even a Ralph Haver home. It's a folk art project made from found objects. To leave it untouched risks further decay, but to restore it risks erasing the very improvisation that made it meaningful. And for the millionth time, wouldn't it be better if we just started appreciating and caring for our local landmarks, even the ones made out of bits of junk? I mean, you know, instead of waiting until they've been assigned a date with a wrecking ball before we step in. A public forum about Mystery Castle is scheduled for early May, giving Phoenicians a rare chance to help decide if Phoenix wants to be a city that keeps its oddities or one that polishes them into marketable assets. Will the castle remain a public curiosity or will it become a private commodity with occasional public hours? Phoenix hasn't historically been great at managing this kind of preservation problem. It's better with clean slates made by knocking down old buildings and starting over again with an empty lot. It'll be interesting to see what becomes of Mystery Castle and whether its resurrection as a destination will rob it of the very character that made it mysterious. For KJZZ, I'm Robert Pala.
That was Robert Pala. You can find more of his work at kjzz.org. Good morning. It is the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger. And now it's time for our next Tiny Desert concert. This time, we'd like to introduce you to a young band that's been called, quote, an electroclash slash indie sleaze revival duo known for intense, self-produced live performances. At least that's how Visit Phoenix described Belgium Tree when they brought them to South by Southwest this year as part of a Phoenix artist showcase. The band is fronted by Dace Santa Cruz and Keanu Klepfer. I spoke with them recently about the band, their music, performing live, and how it all began in their high school Spanish class. You'll hear Keanu first.
It was first day of Spanish. Obviously Mr. Mel asked what we did over the summer. I said I made beats. And he got sitting, I was like, I made beats all over the summer. And like, I think I lied about like making like some kind of fake project of like making rap beats. And then Dace,
it wasn't real.
It was not real. It was so not real. I was just trying to be so cool. Like sometimes you got to fake it to make it. Like, I feel like that's how we do it a lot.
He was saying that like, yeah, I made this rap project with this rapper. That's my friend. It's super, super cool. And I was like, afterwards, I was like, yo, that's awesome. Can I hear the beats? And you were like, Nah. I'll just give you my phone number and I'll send you some beats there.
That's awesome. So you're like high school kids, you're making parody songs, mashups, remakes. When did this become more than, you know, two high school kids messing around with garage band, right?
Yeah. Summer of 2022. Dace came over, I was like house sitting our music teacher's house, and he comes in and he shows me the song called Fishkin Waffle, which is our very first song that we ever released. And it was basically finished. I was like, dude, like, let me just play drums for you. Like, we'll take over everything. Like, let's go on to, like, I was just like delusional. I was like, let's go, let's do this. And then after that, we were like, oh, we should make like a whole project together. So we made a whole project together, started writing together, and like it was like a little bit more legitimate than anything we've ever done before. Mm-hmm. We finished it by like New Year's.
We made a whole EP together. The first song I made, and then I made like another one by myself, and then the rest we made together. Mm-hmm. And Keanu definitely brought it to the next level. He's a very, very, very talented producer that does things I can't do.
So, I mean, you were so young doing this first project. This must have felt pretty cool. Like, did you feel like very accomplished and like you discovered something new about yourselves here?
Yes, a little bit too much. I was like, oh, well, I was still nervous to release it, but because I never told anybody about stuff I released. And once we released it and people like that we knew, like our immediate friends were like, oh, this is good music. I was like, okay, this is awesome. We're going to blow up tomorrow.
Blow up tomorrow. And then probably a week after we released it on Spotify, we were like sitting down, like just like laying on the couch being like, why the hell are we not blowing up right now? We were like, just didn't understand. We were like, why is this not?
Why does this have 200 listens? This is crazy. We should be having a million.
Yeah.
We were definitely.
We're still delusional.
We're still delusional with it. But yeah, we thought it would go a lot more.
a lot of people that we respect and that we've met have talked about like the journey of it being like 10 years or something like that. Like they had to like hustle and grind for such a long time. And so I think that really keeps us going. And I think like we'll be like, all right, we're going to go 100% until I think we're like 35. And then we'll
You've got a 35-year cutoff.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Yeah. It's also just fun. Like, we're in, it's just playing music is fun. So,
It is fun. All right, so you're going to play a song for us now. Tell us about it.
This song is called Drop Me Off. It's a new one. It's about not having your license when you probably should.
Seeing things I'm half awake, and now I understand what Alex say. But the feeling doesn't go away, and now you got me going everywhere. Drop me off, see you later. Your friend, my friend, incubator. Me and you are in the favor. Let's be odds and be together. It's a Death Star, it's a nice car in his backyard, like a postcard. Today, yeah, I'll say, yeah, my place is there. And now I'm feeling free, I'm calling fate. And now I'm pushing it like every day. But now the feeling doesn't go away. And now you got me going everywhere. Drop me off, see you later. Your friend, my friend, incubator. Me and you are in the favor. Let's be odds and be together.
Ask about how you take what you do from the production into the live show, because I mean it was fun to watch, but like you're mixing tracks live, like you've got a little mixer on stage there, you're singing, you had a guitar once or twice but not always, like I mean there's a lot going on, and it's sort of a mixture of a live show and a you know, like a DJ set almost, right?
Yeah. I mean, look, I think we're trying to be cutting edge at the end of the day, and like I think you know, we love electronic music. And we also love like the very 2000s kind of like Interpol kind of era of like New York and stuff. And I think we're just trying to blend that and still have like this live set. Because I think beforehand we just had like one sampler, and me and Dace would like go up there screaming, like clipping the mic and like having like the tracks like blow out every speaker that we would do stuff with. And so we had to kind of like learn to be like, all right, like maybe like let's not do like a karaoke set. Like maybe we should actually do like a live set. So we slowly have been like putting in like synths and like samplers and like guitars and drums to like really make it like a live thing for us. Yeah. And I think we're just trying to have this like blend that no one else has, where it's like, you know, a band that's also like doing a DJ set.
Yeah,
like you said.
It's an interesting mix. Yeah. Do you feel the difference in the audience when you do it like this, as opposed to trying to do it the way you did before?
Definitely.
Our early, the amount of shows we've had, I mean, we kind of, we love a good awkward show. We love making the audience feel.
It definitely happens.
Yeah, for sure.
It happens more to us than a lot of bands.
Yeah. If I had a dollar for every time a show we played went terrible, and like we just fell flat on our faces, and I would be able to retire right now. Whenever things are going especially terrible. We're like, you know what? We'll just take off our shirt. Just let's lean into it.
Yeah, we're just going to go nuts.
Shirt. Yeah, we'll go
just
crazy.
Start hugging people in the crowd. Like, it gets weird. Push-ups. Doing push-ups, getting weird. But I think people sometimes don't know how to react to our stuff. Like, we want everyone, like, dancing and doing stuff. But, like, but I think sometimes people are just not about that, which is totally fine. Like, I, whenever I go to a show, I'm, like, all the way in the back and, like, not doing anything. So I don't know why I expect
other people
being – we are both being extremely hypocritical here.
Yeah, extremely hypocritical.
But talk about some of the moments when your live show has hit and you've really felt, like, the whole crowd in it. Yeah. I mean, what's that feel like?
Amazing. It's the best. I, you know, putting a lot of hard work into a song that, you know – It can only give you so much, like, reward seeing numbers on a screen of, like, who listened to it. Even if it's a lot, it's at the end of the day, it's just a screen saying numbers. So yeah. It's, like, hard to, like, know that translation. So whenever, like, somebody is, like, yelling every word or, like, dancing and, like, knowing everything and, like, doing what we do on stage, that, even if it's just one person, it it hits so hard. It's really... Nothing like it in the world.
Yeah, we did like a show out at Walter Studios opening up for FOMO, and it was a packed Walter Studios, and everyone was vibing, and we had like visuals in the back, and we were only silhouettes, and like that kind of hard work is like amazing, and like it was just like strobes all the time. Like, I don't know, we like overstimulation. I think we're like in that era of like overstimulating, and so
we're like the YouTube shorts of bands.
Yeah, 100%. Like, it's like ADHD on 10. Like, you know what I mean?
Let me ask you, Dace, about writing the songs. Like, where does it start for you for a song? And is it a beat? Is it a line, a chorus, a story?
The way it works for me is I usually just have a mood that I'm in, whatever I'm feeling, and I'll write down just like lyrics that kind of encapsulate how I'm feeling. And then whenever I'm still kind of sitting in that mood, whether like that time period of me when I wrote that, I just go to the computer and usually just start with guitar and just try to make something. And then it's a matter of just like, okay, how can I rewrite these lyrics to fit to this melody that I just made to this instrumental?
Let me ask you then, Keanu, about the production stuff, right? Like, do you take a stripped back sounding, almost folky song from this guy and then turn it into something that sounds like what you did out there?
Yeah, kind of. Yeah,
that's crazy. How do you do that?
I wish I can answer it. I think, like, you know, at some point you're an antenna of just like ideas, and like I think like it kind of goes by super fast where like you don't know, but I don't know, we're trying to make like these like crazy sounds happen with like great pop songs and these like great kind of songs, and I think that's just I wish I could answer that better.
I'll answer it. He is goated. That's why he literally just does it. It's so crazy.
So where do you want to take this? Where do you guys see this going? Is this a long-term project for you? You said age 35, you're done?
Yeah. Yeah.
You got some time.
Yeah, we have time. 19, 21. Yeah, we have time.
Yeah.
I don't know yet. I mean, we're just going to keep grinding, keep on trying to make the best music we can and make smash records.
Yeah, I think... I think we're just trying to influence, like, more kids, too, to, like, really, like, try to blend something and to make something that's like newer. You know what I mean? I think like, I think that's the most important thing, you know?
Well, Dace, Keanu, thank you both so much. Thanks for performing for us. Appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
All right. So let's have you take us out on a song. What are you going to play for us?
This one is called It's Only What's Good.
Try to vacate this place, but I stay.
And you can watch this performance by Belgium Tree on our website and our YouTube page as part of our Tiny Desert Concert Series. They played in front of a full-scale model of a Mars rover at ASU School of Earth and Space Exploration. It was super cool. I was there. Go take a look. All right, and that'll do it for this edition of the show. We will, of course, be back with you again tomorrow morning with much more. Don't forget to follow us on Instagram. We are at KJZZ The Show. And you can sign up for the show's weekly newsletter. It is called Radioheads. You can sign up at theshow.kjzz.org. For Mark Brody, I'm Lauren Gilger. Thanks for joining us. Thanks for listening to the show's podcast. The show is produced by Sativa Peterson, Nick Sanchez, Amber Victoria Singer, Athena Ankra, and Ayana Hamilton. The show was created by John Hoban, and our executive producer is Amy Silverman.